If you brought your Bibles, would you please open them to Colossians chapter 1. We're going to be starting in verse 21. Leslie Casserly will be reading our passage for today.
Colossians 1, 21 to 23. Once you were alienated from God and were enemies in your minds because of your evil behavior, but now he has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death, to present you holy in his sight, without blemish, and free from accusation if you continue in your faith, established and firm, and do not move from the hope held out in the gospel. This is the gospel that you heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven, and of which I, Paul, have become a servant.
Good morning. A quick congrats to Grandpa and Grandma Langford, who just celebrated the birth of their first granddaughter, Lily. John and Laura had their child yesterday, so lots of fun babies and things like that. How does it feel to be grandparents?
Great.
She's beautiful. Must come from the mother's side. Or at least the paternal mother's side. Thank you, Jan. Sorry. Well, we're continuing. In our last week, we saw just really one of the high points in all of the New Testament, this beautiful description of Jesus in verse 15 to 20 as the image of the invisible God, as Lord over all creation. And today, I think we come to an almost equally another high point in the New Testament. And my NIV, the last sentence in this passage, verse 23, Paul says, "This is the gospel." And I thought, wow, it's rare in the Bible that you get someone just explicitly saying, "This is the gospel." And so I thought, well, this would be a good opportunity today to share what the gospel is. In case anyone is wondering, what is the gospel? And the gospel, that word, of course, means good news. There's this good news of what the God of the universe has done in Jesus Christ. And so my simple goal today is for all of us to hear what is the gospel. And I want you to hear that, whether you've been hearing it for 40 or 50 years. And I want you to hear that even if this is the first time in your life that you've heard the good news that is given to us in the Bible. And we're not only going to hear the good news today, we're actually going to taste the good news today. You'll notice we have some tables up here. And we're actually, it's going to be a little different today. We're going to give you two opportunities through the service to come up here and taste something of what the good news is all about. And I will explain that to you in a little bit. But before I go into the details of the passage, look at verse 22, this word, "But now he has reconciled you," okay? If all you walk away with today is a word, it's that word, reconcile. The gospel in a word is the gospel of reconciliation. And we're going to talk about what reconciliation is all about. But you'll notice, look at verse 21 and 22. Look at the pattern. 21 starts with the word "once." Once you were this, and 22 starts, "but now this has happened." Once this was the case, but now this is the case. And it's a classic Christian formula, once, but now. We sing a very famous song that says, "I once was lost," right? "But now I'm found." There's a before and an after that is all about reconciliation. Actually, that phrase, "once was lost, but now I'm found," the author of that hymn did not pen that phrase. You know where that phrase comes from? Guess, it's always the right answer. Jesus. Yeah, "once was lost, but now I'm found." That comes from a story Jesus told, the greatest story of reconciliation, a story, and I thought I'd just share that story on the front end. It's a story we know as the prodigal son, right? It's a story of a father, this loving, gracious, amazing father who has this son. He actually has two sons. And the younger son when he comes of age, decides that he doesn't want anything to do with his father anymore, that he wants his share of the inheritance. He basically says, you're dead to me, Dad. I want what I would get when you die. I want that inheritance now. And he goes off, and he decides to live for himself. He goes to a faraway country, and he lives and makes his own choices and squanders his inheritance. And when he's out there, he basically suffers the consequences of his own self-reliant decisions. And he remembers back to his father's home and the care that even his father's servants get. And so he comes to his senses, and he comes back to his father to give this speech about how he's not worthy to be a son, but could at least he be a servant. And you guys know the story, but his father, when he sees his sons, he comes running out. He embraces him. He smothers him with kisses. He throws him this wonderful party, kills the fattened calf, and it's a story of, what's the word? Reconciliation. And the father says, this son of mine was once lost, but now he is found. He has been reconciled. We've been reconciled. And so as we look at this passage, I want you to just have that story in the back of your mind, and I'll keep drawing us back to it. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to look at verse 21 and 22. First, let's look at the once. What was our situation? What was our reality with God before Jesus? And then we'll turn and look at verse 22. And but now, what is our relationship with God like because of what he's done through Jesus Christ? And we'll have a chance to taste each of those realities together today. So first, let's look at verse 21. Once, this is how it was. Once, and here's the word, you were alienated from God and were enemies. Here's the once in a word. It is this: alienation. Okay, now I don't know how that word strikes you. That's a very poignant word to me. That word carries a sense of hostility, of conflict, but also of separation and isolation. And Paul's saying that was the nature of reality before Jesus Christ: alienation. And he goes on to tell us why. What's the cause of that alienation? Look at verse 21. You were alienated from God and your enemies. Here's why. In your minds, because of your evil behavior. He's saying, we made a decision. We had a mindset that led to this alienation. And we committed behaviors, actions that led to this alienation. So I want to talk about that for a second. What's the mindset? And then what is the lifestyle that leads to this alienation? First, let's look at the minds. Or even mindset would be a good one. Paul's saying, you had a mindset within you that led to this alienation. And there's a lot about this mindset, but if I could just sum it up, I would sum it up in the decision that the first two human beings made, okay? Adam and Eve. It's the mindset that we all have inherited from them. And you know the story. God puts them in a garden, in this beautiful place, to experience relationship with him. And he puts in the garden a tree, right? No one knows if it's an apple tree or not. Probably not an apple tree in the Middle East, but who knows? It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And God says, you can eat every tree. I don't want you to eat that tree. And here's what he's saying. I want you to trust me. I don't want you to decide for yourself what is good and what is evil. I know what is good and what is evil. I know what is healthy for you and what is unhealthy. You depend on me for that knowledge. And everything will go great. And the man and the woman look at this opportunity and they say, no, God, we're not going to trust you. We are going to decide for ourselves what is good and what is evil. We'll decide for ourselves what is right and what is wrong. We will decide for ourselves what we think will lead to fulfillment in life and what won't. And we're going to decide that apart from you. Okay? That's at the heart of this mindset. It's a mindset that says, I'm going to decide for myself what's good and what's wrong. I'm going to decide for myself what's going to lead to my fulfillment and happiness in life. I'm old enough, I'm an adult, I'm going to decide for myself how I live. I'm not going to stay under my father's rules anymore. I'm going to go and I'm going to figure this thing out for myself. Next week, we're going to celebrate our nation's Declaration of Independence. This is the ultimate declaration of independence from the Creator. We declare our independence. We are going to decide how to live apart from you because we think we know what's going to lead to our happiness and joy. And so we'll make that decision for ourselves. And today we are living in a culture that not only accepts that mindset, but actually celebrates that mindset, right? You decide for yourself what is right for you. What's going to bring happiness? Don't let anybody else decide that. Certainly don't let a God decide that. You decide for yourselves. That's the mindset. And that is the mindset that is behind every single sin that we commit. And so Paul goes on. He says, this alienation came because of this mindset you have and because of your evil behavior. This mindset plays itself out in all sorts of behaviors in life. Let me show you some of those behaviors that Paul mentions in chapter 3 of Colossians. It gives us a really good list of behaviors that come from this mindset. Here's how it starts. Sexual immorality, impurity, lust. Okay, this mindset plays out in the sexual arena, where human beings say, I know what God says about sex and how it is created to be expressed in the context of a marriage, but I'm going to decide for myself what I think is going to lead to fulfillment, even if it means doing that outside of what God has said. Or, of course, today, even gender itself is up for grabs, right? I'm going to decide for myself whether I'm a man or woman, regardless of what God's biological design of me says. He goes on, evil desires and greed, which is idolatry. Okay, God had designed and said, I want you guys to worship me. You can enjoy life, but worship me and everything will be put in its right place. And there's a mindset that says, no, I think I'll decide for myself what I'm going to worship. And instead of worshiping the Creator, we turn to the things he created, amazing things, and we start worshiping them. Possessions, relationships, money. And we think, I'm going to find fulfillment in those things. I'll decide for myself that those are what's best for me. He goes on one more. Anger, rage, malice, slander, and filthy language from your lips. And this must be a gospel message right now. This is getting ugly. I'm not enjoying this right now. You guys enjoying this? These are nasty things. So notice these. These are kind of relational sins, okay? This is what happens when you take individuals who in their heart say, I think I'll decide for myself what is right and wrong. When you take those individuals and all put them in a room together, okay? These are the kinds of things that happen. People trying to express themselves, assert themselves, it creates all this conflict with one another. The sin behind the sin is that decision. I think I'll decide for myself. And it plays itself out in a multitude of ways. And I just want to acknowledge, because most of us grew up in the church, there's also a religious version of this, okay? I mean, most of us, we see this and we think, oh, you're talking about the secular people who are, you know, atheists and don't know God. There is a religious version of this. And it is found in the second son in the story of the prodigal son. And it's a posture that says, I know that inside I'm kind of broken and I'm needy and I'm messy. And I hate that feeling. I hate that feeling. And the last thing I want is to be in that place and just need the grace of a God in my life. So I'm going to pursue religion as a way of trying to deal with those feelings inside. I'm going to try really hard to be a good person, to be a moral person, to come to church, to read my Bible, to serve, to do these things that will deal with that feeling I have of brokenness inside. I don't really want a God to save me my brokenness. I want to save myself through my own good works. And so there's a religious version of this. It's the older brother in the parable. He's out in the fields. He's still in his father's estate, but he is not reconciled to his father. He is earning his way. He is, through his own efforts, trying hard not to need his father, but to earn his father's approval. The result is the same, whether it's a religious version or irreligious version, alienation. You guys with me? Yeah? So I want you to think for a second, just in human relationships, you know when two people are in conflict with each other, when they're alienated from each other, what is it that keeps them from coming back together? Is it not, it's the posture that they have to one another, right? There's bitterness, there's resentment, there's pride, there's an unwillingness to come together. And that's how it is with God and humanity. I've already described our posture. It's that self-reliant, prideful posture that says, no, I'm going to live the way I want to live. That's our posture towards the Creator, whether religious or irreligious. And do you know what the Creator's posture towards us in this is? It's not a happy word. The word, the biblical word, is wrath. And wrath is nothing more than God's steady, firm opposition to sin, to evil. Okay? It's part of his goodness. And 99% of the time, the way that God expresses his wrath is this. He says, you want your independence? Fine. You can have your independence. I will grant you your independence, and you will live with the consequences of cutting yourself off from me. Again, think of the parable, right? The son says, I want out. I want to live my life the way I want to. And the father says, okay, you may. And you will experience the consequences of your independence. We were designed for life inside the Father's house. We were designed for life in Eden, in the garden, to experience the shalom, the closeness and relationship. And we chose to cut ourselves off for that. And so now every morning, even as Christians or not, we wake up in a world that for the most part is outside of Eden. We wake up every day outside of Eden. We wake up in a world that is alienated. And we experience that alienation all around us. We wake up to things like shootings in Florida. We wake up to racial tension all over our country. We wake up to corporate fraud. We wake up to political corruption, to violence and war. And we experience that alienation even within ourselves, not just around us, but within us, right? We wake up and we still feel this brokenness or loneliness or bitterness or jealousy or shame or guilt. We wake up and we find ourselves outside of the garden because of our own declaration of independence. In a word, alienation. So what I want to do is I want to give us just a couple minutes to get in touch with this alienation. Even as Christians, we can still experience the effects of this. And so here's what we're going to do. In just a second. And there's some bread and some juice. Don't touch those, okay? There's two bowls, and one of the bowls is some parsley. There's no such thing as a parsley allergy, is there? I wouldn't assume, I don't think, hopefully. But the parsley represents the life that God created, the goodness of life and creation, the freshness and wonder and joy of life. But we're going to take that parsley, and then you're going to dip it in a cup of salt water. And the salt water, of course, represents the tears, the grief, and the pain that comes from being alienated from the Creator. The natural consequences of humanity's choice to say, no, we're going to decide for ourselves how to live, okay? So we're going to not just consider alienation, but we're going to taste the alienation together, all right? So, and as we come up, Mark is going to lead us in a time of confession, and he'll describe that in a second. But I want to just give you a second, just about 30 seconds of silence. And my question would be this. How are you experiencing this alienation in your life right now? Where are you feeling it? And let me just suggest, for some of you, it might be you are feeling the consequences of your own decisions. You've made some decisions recently, and your life, there's some hard parts in your life, and it's a result of your own bad choice. Others of you might, where you relate is, you are experiencing the consequences of somebody else's bad decision. You're just experiencing some of the consequences of living in a world that has fallen and cut off from its Creator. So either one of us, most of us, we could probably identify with both, all right? But I want to give you about 30 seconds of silence, and just be in touch with that. Where right now in your life, where are you experiencing the reality of living in a world that for the most part is alienated from its Creator? Let's take a second to do that, and then I'll direct us towards the tables. So let's do this. When you're ready, come to one of these five tables. Doesn't have to be one closest to you. Look for the one with the shortest line. And come on up. I'm going to have Mark come up. As we do this, he's going to lead us in a time of confession. But he's going to do that as you just come to the table. So as you're ready, why don't you come on up.
I'm going to walk us through a series of confessions. Many of you are familiar with this. We're going to take a slow walk through these things. And so while you're sitting, while you're standing in line, listen to these confessions. At the end of the confession, I'm going to say, Lord, in your mercy. And I'd like all of us to respond in unison to that by saying, hear our prayer. All right? So there'll be also... the confessions will be on the PowerPoint, but when I say, Lord, in your mercy, you can say, hear our prayer. So let's be prayerful as we consider these confessions. Almighty God, we confess that we have sinned against you in thought, word, and deed, by what we have done and by what we have left undone. Lord, first we confess the things we have done that we should not have done. We confess our pride, lust, hypocrisy, and impatience. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. We confess our self-centered appetites and ways, and the way we take advantage of other people to get what we want. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. We confess our jealousy towards those who have more than us. Lord, in your mercy, hear our prayer. We confess our love of worldly goods and our dishonesty in daily life and work. Lord, in your mercy. We confess our judgmentalism, our unloving thoughts towards our neighbors, and our prejudice towards those who are different from us. Lord, in your mercy. We confess the ways we try to hide, cover, or make up for our sin apart from Jesus. Lord, in your mercy. And Lord, we confess the things we have left undone, that which we should have done. We confess that we have not loved you with our whole heart. We have not loved our neighbors as ourselves. We have not forgiven others as we have been forgiven. Lord, in your mercy. We have failed to seek you first in prayer and worship. We have failed to diligently search your word for guidance, strength, and truth. Lord, in your mercy. We have often been blind to human need and suffering. We often ignore the poor and needy, the oppressed, and the powerless. Lord, in your mercy. We have failed to be faithful stewards of your creation, and we have shown a lack of concern for those who come after us. Lord, in your mercy. We have been deaf to your call to serve as Christ served us. We have been afraid to share the faith that is in us with the world. Amen.
verse 22 begins with these great small words. But now. Once, but now. And here's the but now. He has reconciled you. This is the gospel in a word. Reconciliation. From alienation to reconciliation. And for me, as poignant of a word as alienation is, reconciliation is equally poignant in all the great ways. To reconciliation implies being brought back together, being reunited. It has a tone of closeness, of peace, of freedom from conflict. Reconciliation. Beautiful. And the gospel is this: God, the God of the universe, has brought about reconciliation for you. How has he done that? Look at verse 22. He has reconciled you. Here's how. By Christ's physical body through death. That's how he did it. By Christ's physical body through death. Look at verse 20, the end of it. In my translation says this: making peace through his blood shed on the cross. God reconciles you to himself through the work of Jesus Christ on the cross, through the death of his body, through the shedding of his blood. And we're really familiar with this story, right? We've all heard that a lot of times. So we forget how strange this is and what a surprising thing this is that God did. And let me just try to bring it home this way. It's a really weird thing to do, to kill Jesus, to bring reconciliation between us and God the Father, okay? So like if you and I were in conflict with each other, okay, we are alienated from each other, it'd be a weird thing to say, hey, let's find a third party and let's kill him and that will solve the conflict between us, right? That's a strange story to tell. And yet that's the story of the gospel. God and us are in conflict and the death of Jesus on the cross somehow solves the problem of that conflict. How is it? Why does that work? Well, I think it goes back to what I said earlier about when you're in conflict with each other, there's a posture that you have towards one another. And what Jesus' death on the cross does is fundamentally change God's posture towards us. Because the reality is the biggest issue in our alienation, the biggest barrier is actually not our posture towards God. That independent, I'll do it myself posture. It's actually God's posture towards us. That's the biggest barrier keeping reconciliation from happening. God's wrath that says, it's the fundamental expression of a holy being, of a perfect being, who looks at sinners as a perfectly just being and says, this rebellion, this evil, this sin, it deserves to be judged in a just way. There is a just punishment for that. And the just punishment for saying we'll go our own way is to say, fine, you can go that way forever. You can have your separation. You will experience death and separation from me forever. That's the just punishment, is death. And so what Jesus' death on the cross does is it fundamentally changes God's posture towards us. Jesus is God coming in the flesh to identify with our humanity, and not just our humanity, but to actually identify as sinful humanity, to take on himself these sins, these accusations that are leveled towards us that are true, to take them on himself, to go to the cross, and in his body, through the shedding of his blood, to serve the sentence that our crimes deserve, to pay the penalty that God's justice demands. And to do that in our place, in our stead, as a substitute, so that that wrath is expressed towards Jesus on the cross, justice is served, and God's posture towards us fundamentally changes. He says, hey, that's been taken care of. It's done. It's been dealt with in Jesus. Now, my posture towards you has fundamentally changed. Look at what he says. Verse 22. He has reconciled you by Christ's physical body through death. Why? Look at this. To present you holy in his sight, without blemish and free from accusation. Let me put that up there. To present you in his sight. When you stand in my presence, God says, here is now the posture I have towards you. I see you as holy. I see you as without blemish. I see you as free from accusation. Now, I just want to touch on those last two for a second. Without blemish. Blemish is not a word I use a lot these days. Trying to think of what a better word might be. How about without fault? How about the word, when I think of blemish, I think of the word flawed. Without a flaw. And how many of you would, if you're honest, you'd go, as I look at my life, as I look inside and who I am, if I'm honest, I kind of feel like there's some fundamental flaws to me. There's a fundamental brokenness. There's dysfunction, maybe is a word we would use. I feel not enough. I feel inadequate. In some ways, I feel damaged. And that creates a level of shame in our lives. I feel blemished. I feel flawed. I am flawed. Others of you maybe connect more with that last line, free from accusation. When you look inside your heart, what you see is lots of voices of accusation. There are things that you do in your past that continue to haunt you, things that you do, and you hear these voices of accusation, and you feel a level of guilt, right? And God is saying, now, you are without blemish in my sight. Now you are free from accusation. And that's the gospel. And that's so good. Because I think it's those, for many of us, it's those feelings of being flawed, of being accused. Those are actually the things that keep us from God. Because when you feel that way, you're like, the last thing I want to do is engage a perfect holy being. Because I know what I'm going to get. Like I'm going to get some, I'm already feeling guilty. And so we stay away. I think of the story of the prodigal son, right? The son is off. He made these bad decisions. And I think one of the things that keeps him from going back to his father is his sense of unworthiness, right? Like, how can I go back after what I've done? I mean, he even said, he rehearses this speech in his mind when he's off in the other country. He says, I know I can't be my father's son anymore, but maybe I can go back and be his servant. I don't deserve to be his son, so maybe I can go back as a servant. He rehearses a speech that says, Father, I am no longer worthy. I'm not worthy to be your son. Can I at least be your servant? And the truth is, he is not worthy to be his father's son. But the deeper truth in that is this. The father gets to decide whether or not he's worthy. And so before he can even rehearse his speech, the father embraces him. He smothers him with kisses, and he performs these actions. He puts a ring on his finger. He puts a robe on his back. He kills the fattened calf. Strange things in our day. But this is giving him his status back as a son, saying, no, you are not a servant. You are my son. It doesn't matter how you feel right now. What matters is what I'm deciding, that you are my son because I love you. And my posture towards you is one of acceptance and embrace, and I am so glad you're here. Welcome home, son. The reality is he's not worthy, but he doesn't get to decide. The father decides, no, you're my son. And so we're going to celebrate, and we're going to throw a party. And that really is the beauty of the gospel, is that God has reconciled us, that the father gets to decide what he thinks about us. And what he has done in Jesus Christ frees him so that now as he sees us as holy and without blemish, free from accusation. He says, I have nothing against you. I got nothing but love and acceptance and embrace. I have done everything that needs to be done for us to be reconciled. Okay? There's not a single action of ours in verse 22. It's all God's action. He has come all the way to bring reconciliation. And I just love that because normally when two people are in conflict, you know, if you ever tried to counsel two people in conflict, what do you say? You say, okay, guys, you got to meet in the middle, right? You got to compromise. You got to find common ground. That's not how reconciliation works with God. We were the ones who created all of the alienation. And yet the gospel is that God has come all the way to bring reconciliation. He is like the father who runs out and embraces his son. One poem calls him, he's the hound of heaven. He's like this hound that pursues and pursues. It's all his action. That's why it's good news and not good advice. It's something to be believed in. So what do we do if it's all God's work? Verse 23, take a look. If you continue in your faith, what do? We put our faith in what God has done in Jesus Christ, which is to say, we simply trust what God did. We take that self-reliant, independent posture that we had, and we see the lengths that God has gone for us. That posture melts in us. And we go, oh, I'm an idiot. I want this. Yes, I'm going to trust what you have done for me. We come to our senses and we trust in what he's done. That's what happens in the story of the prodigal son, right? The turning point, it says, when he came to his senses, he finally comes to his senses and realizes life in the Father's house is so much better. And that's all faith is. It's the opposite of works. It's recognizing we can't do anything. You have done everything. And so I'm going to trust what you've done. And now I'm going to entrust my life to you. Because me living it for myself doesn't work so well. So I'm going to trust in what you've done. And Paul clarifies the kind of faith he's talking about. Look at verse 23. If you continue in your faith, established and firmed, not moved from the hope held out in the gospel. All that to say, the kind of faith that Paul's talking about is not just a momentary decision we make in a service or at a camp or at a crusade or something like that, though it can start there. But he's saying, no, this is a life decision. This is one that you continue to go to every day, that you stop trusting in yourself and you turn to what God has done and you say, I accept. You have conquered me. You've tracked me down. I accept the reconciliation that you offer. That's a good thing. And so what we're going to do to close the service is we're going to give ourselves a few minutes, just as we did with the alienation, to be in touch with the reconciliation that God has given to us, that he has offered us in the good news. And so we're going to take communion together, as you have guessed. And communion is this, it's this amazing thing we get to do regularly together. And as I see it, there's two things happening in communion. One is this, one is maybe theological. And what Jesus is doing in giving us communion, he's reminding us of what he did on the cross, okay? The bread, you're going to take a piece of the bread, you're going to break it, and it's a reminder to you that Jesus' body was broken to bring reconciliation, okay? He took on himself your brokenness, and he was broken for your brokenness. You're going to dip that in the cup of juice. The cup of juice, of course, represents his blood that, as verse 20 says, that was shed for you so that you could have reconciliation. So, and on the one hand, what communion is there is to remind us of what Jesus did for us. But the other thing I just want to say, just on a very practical, personal level, do you know what communion is? Communion is simply Jesus inviting us to share a meal with him. That's what it is. This is his table, okay? Where he is both the meal and the host of the table. And just look at this as Jesus is inviting you to share a meal with him. I wish this was a much bigger meal rather than one little piece. But that's what this is. This is like the father in the parable son saying, come inside and let's celebrate. Let's share a meal because I have done everything that needs to happen so that you can be my son, you can be my daughter. So I would invite you just to see this. This is Jesus reaching out his arms to you and saying, let's share a meal together this morning. And you don't just do it as an individual with him, but we get to do it together because we are his body. Okay? Say one last thing. You might find yourself in one of three places this morning. Some of you here, this is the first time you've ever heard the gospel, the good news, of what God has done in Jesus in bringing you back to himself. And today you're like, yes, I want that. I want to put my trust in what Jesus did for me, and I want to entrust my life to him. That's what it means to become a Christian. It means to trust in what Jesus did for you and then to entrust your life and say, I don't want to keep doing this by myself. Life stinks when I do this by myself. I want to give this over to you. Okay? Today can be the day where you say yes to Jesus. And I would invite you to this table as an act of saying to Jesus in a very physical, tangible way, I trust you. And so to get up out of your seat, to walk here to these tables, say, yes, I want to come to you. And to take this bread, dip it in the cup, and say, yes, I want to trust in what you did for me. And so maybe this is the first time you've ever done this. And this is a great opportunity for you to do that. If this is, I would please invite you to come and talk to me, or we'll have a couple people up front after the service, or someone in this room that you know, just so we can keep the conversation going with you. But if this is you, this is a great opportunity to do that. Others of you, you maybe would identify as a Christian, but as you look at your life, you would say, you know what? I've been distant from God for a while. I mean, I feel like I'm outside the Father's house. I've kind of been doing my own thing. I'm still going through the motions, still coming to church. But if I'm honest, I feel like it's been a long time since I've really experienced a closeness with God. And maybe this is God's way of saying, hey, come on back in. I want to be close. I don't want us to be two ships passing in the night. I want to embrace you, and I want us to be close. And this can be your opportunity to say, yes, I want that, Lord. I need that. This can be that. And then finally, some of you, maybe you'd say, you know what, life with God is pretty good right now. But maybe there's an area of your life, just some specific area where you're experiencing pain, brokenness, where you just need God to kind of come in and say, God, I need you just to kind of be with me in this situation in my life right now. I want to experience your presence, your closeness, your encouragement. And maybe this is a way for him to say, yeah, I'm with you. Let's share a meal together and let's share it in that area of your life. So that's what we're going to do. Again, 5 tables. When you're ready, come on up and we'll sing a couple songs as you do that. So this is the Lord's table, and he invites you to it. So when you're ready, come and share a meal with your Lord.